Walker on behalf of the appellant Calvin Byrd. The state relied primarily on a first-time in-court identification by Officer Blackston of Mr. Byrd as one of the perpetrators of a burglary. The trial court denied Mr. Byrd his right to due process when it permitted the jury to consider this unreliable identification that was the result of an unnecessarily suggestive process. 6 months prior to trial, Officer Blackston was called to an alleged robbery in progress being conducted by three black males. When he arrived at the home, he entered the foyer, and there were no lights on in the house. He heard individuals upstairs and announced his presence. After he did that, he heard the individuals running down the steps, which faced away from him and were 15 feet away from him. When the men reached the base of the steps, they then continued another 3 feet out the back door. According to the officer, it was at that time, prior to their exiting, that the individuals briefly looked over their shoulder for 1 second at the officer and then continued on. Michael Newkirk was arrested by the officer. Unfortunately for him, the other individual continued on. Shortly thereafter, Tyree Pollard was arrested in the area as one of the suspects. Mr. Pollard and Mr. Byrd went to trial together, and Mr. Newkirk was tried separately. At trial, for the first time, defense counsel learned that the state sought to use the officer to identify Mr. Byrd. There had been no indication of any pretrial identification procedures. And in fact, the chief investigating officer testified that the reason he did that was he was afraid the officer would not be able to identify them because he only saw their backs. There is no testimony at trial as to what description the officer previously gave when he put out the description on the radio of this individual. However, the description he gave at trial was generic and vague. He stated that the suspect was light in color, had a black jacket, wore cornrows, and was not as heavy as the other individual. The United States Supreme Court, Neal versus Bigger, set forth an analysis for the court to conduct in order to determine whether a pretrial identification is unnecessarily suggestive and or reliable if it is suggestive. The factors that the court is to consider with respect to reliability is the opportunity of the witness to see the crime, the attention to detail to the crime by the witness, the accuracy of any prior description, the certainty of the witness, and finally the length of time between the initial confrontation and the testimony at trial.
Can you help me? I'm going to expose for all to see my age in criminal procedure here. My understanding of pretrial identification from Simmons on anyway was that there was some mechanism used between the incident itself, where an eyewitness may or may not have seen the perpetrator, and an in-court identification, which by its nature would be tainted and suggest that the witness in court was identifying not the person who perpetrated the crime, but identifying a person through a tainted pretrial procedure, it being the one on trial,
right,
in the in-court identification. Now, unless I'm totally mistaken here, what we're dealing with is someone who had information at or near the time of the crime and then used that information without anything in between to be suggestive or to taint that original memory and made an in-trial identification. Mm-hmm. I've never thought of that circumstance, particularly under our case law, which is even in numerous instances says you can cure a pretrial identification taint by a clear and unequivocal in-court identification. This is a wholly new construct for me.
Mm-hmm.
Help me figure out why cross-examination of your ability to identify someone at or near the time of the crime is some kind of suggestive pretrial identification.
Well, it's not a suggestive pretrial identification. The argument here is that Biggers applies to first-time in-court identifications. Cross-examination does not cure that problem because of the basis behind Biggers and Manson and Stovall is that suggestive confrontations are disapproved because they increase the likelihood of misidentification, and that's regardless of whether it's pretrial or at trial. And in fact, unnecessary suggestive confrontations are condemned because the chance of misidentification is gratuitous.
But logically, wouldn't that mean, let's say you're a clerk in a liquor store and someone robs the liquor store, the police take the facts from you about what you saw in your description, you only saw the person for maybe 15 seconds, and then the next time you see someone's in the courtroom and you say, that is the person that robbed me, that's suggestive pretrial identification?
It's not a suggestive pretrial identification. It is suggestive, and the question becomes, and in fact, the trial court in this case found it to be suggestive. The suggestiveness here is the actual setup of the courtroom. That's the suggestiveness.
So are you advocating a new rule for every time someone is the victim of a crime or a witness to a crime, and the next time they see them in court, we need a new rule before they're allowed to identify the person in court?
If the defense attorney challenges it, what the rule should be, it's not a per se rule, is that if the defense objects to the fact that the circumstances are suggestive, the court needs to do an analysis as to its reliability.
Well, no. We've been through cases where you rule out the defendant seated at counsel table in leg irons and handcuffs and an orange jumpsuit, and people are dressed in civilian clothes, but they are, more often than not, where they want to be positioned to be able to see the jury and see the witnesses. So they are often the sole person other than counsel, known or suspected to be counsel by the witness, whether it's a police officer or otherwise. How would we change the construct under your theory? Have the defendant sit in the audience and have an empty chair, or a person that resembles the defendant as closely as possible but isn't the defendant, in order to trick the witness? I don't get how this is supposed to work.
Okay. Well, so jurisdictions handle that differently. Some of them say that the court does not have an obligation to ensure that there's a lineup, just simply to ensure there's not a show-up, which is what this amounted to in this case. Because of the lack of pretrial identification, the generic description, the officer's lack of opportunity to observe the individual. A normal circumstance, yes, again, I believe that as looking at many cases, they all agree that it is suggestive to some degree, the courtroom setup. And that's not in and of itself the challenge here. So in every case, one's not asking that, you know, we be able to trick the witnesses. What needs to happen then is the defense attorney says, this is inherently suggestive, and I want the court to make a determination as to its reliability. And then the court needs to do that. 9 times out of 10, it's going to be found to be reliable because the witnesses have a lengthy period of time to observe the person, or there's been pretrial identification procedures.
And how do we get to that point under your scenario? If the witness is on the stand and says the defendant is the person I saw that night, and we do that in the absence of the jury, and then they've already identified them. But if your position is going to work, you don't want the witness to see the defendant until they're in some setting that you conclude is neutral. Mm-hmm. So it would seem that in every case, the defense attorney would make an application to the judge and say, Your Honor, the witness hasn't seen the perpetrator since the time of the crime, and my client, the defendant, wasn't the perpetrator. I don't want the witness to see my client in the courtroom before they testify and identify him. Here's what I want you to do. So what are the choices?
Well, the choices would be for the trial court to do a voir dire, I guess, similar to what they do with expert testimony and under a Getz analysis, to determine the reliability of the evidence prior to it going to the jury. The point is not that the
Well, in this case, the officer says, and I saw him for 2 seconds, then I saw him for 4 seconds. And the judge says, fine, if you can still identify them, I'm going to let you make the identification. And what's the standard of review on that?
Well, it's de novo because it's a due process violation. The argument was made that he didn't have a fair trial as a result of the unduly suggestive identification. And it was only one second.
So are you saying here as a matter of law, the brevity of the interaction meant as a matter of law, this identification should never have taken place in this case?
No. As a matter of law, the court should have conducted a second step in an analysis. He determined that it was suggestive circumstances, but he did not conduct a reliability analysis, which includes an opportunity. That's not the only factor. It includes the opportunity to see the offender, as well as the attention to detail, accuracy of any prior descriptions, certainty of identification, and the length of time since the original confrontation. And in with respect to that, I think it's clear what that there was limited opportunity here. I don't know that there's much dispute to that. The accuracy of any prior description, there is no accuracy. There is nothing to measure that by. In fact, the witnesses that were in the neighborhood that day and said they saw our client in the area never described him as wearing a black shirt or cornrows that day. So there's no way to measure the accuracy of the officer's description. And
you agree that the majority of courts that have addressed this have not extended Biggers to in-court identification?
Your Honor, I'm not clear that it is a majority of the courts. I know a couple of the cases say that. I think, and as I continue to dig, I've found some here and there, but there are several federal jurisdictions that do adopt it. And the Third Circuit, while not an identical set of facts, has come very close to saying that, in fact, in-court identification is subject to the test under Biggers.
Well, that case, which I printed out, has emblazoned upon it that all the rules the Third Circuit has about it not being citable for precedent because under their rules it's not reviewed by all the circuit judges. So should we rely upon it if they don't rely upon it?
There are actually three Third Circuit cases. And to be honest, I don't know which one the court is referring to.
The one that was cited in your brief, I think, Atkinson.
Atkinson. Well, there's also Emmanuel, which occurred, and Lambert. In Lambert, there had been pretrial procedures, but the defendant had not been identified at that time. And then the in-court identification, the court relied on Biggers' analysis. In United States versus Emmanuel, there was a confrontation between the witness and the defendant right outside the courtroom, right before trial when the guy was in manacles. There was nothing there to taking those three cases together. It is clear that the court did not seem to have any big dispute with respect to whether Biggers would apply in this set of circumstances.
What's wrong with the approach that the Ninth Circuit has under Domina?
Well, actually nothing. And in fact, the Domina court is actually, the difference between Domina and what's being requested here is this. They apply the two-part test, whether it was inherently suggestive, and if so, whether it was reliable. And it says that there could, they looked at it as an abuse of discretion, and it occurs only if the resulting in-court identifications are so unnecessarily suggestive and conducive to irreparable misidentification. The difference between Domina and what is being proposed here is they did not necessarily embrace the factors for reliability as to opportunity and certainty and all those other factors. And even under the Domina and they limited their holding to the circumstances in that case. It was very clear. And here we have very little opportunity. One second they saw a face, and by the way, he never gave a description of any face. And
Can I interrupt for a second?
Yes.
You're asking the court to adopt the Biggers set of factors that would apply to a first-time in-court identification, right?
Yes.
And if I understand how this would work, the state says we're going to present a witness who's going to make an identification, at which point defense counsel would be free to say, well, I would like a Biggers analysis by the court. And the jury would go away, and I assume, and then there would be some testimony and cross-examination, I guess, for a short time as to, you know, how long did you see the person, how long ago was it, you know, how much detail can you give us about, and so on. And after getting all that information, the court would say, sounds good enough to me, or it doesn't, and it would be reviewed for abuse of discretion? I'm asking.
Yeah. Well, yes, for evidentiary purposes, but if the defendant is making a constitutional argument for due process purposes, the de novo review would be invoked at that point.
Well, how would we know which is which, you know, which one is going on here?
Well, hopefully the defense attorney, I'm sure they don't always do this, would be clear in his argument. I suppose that if he didn't make it clear, there would be an argument by the state that it was abuse of discretion or plain error.
Well, that confuses me, because after you have the examination outside the presence of the jury and you've requested the trial judge to make the determination, that is due process. You've gotten your notice, your opportunity to be heard. So why would the factual findings made by the trial judge, presumably allowing the testimony, be reviewed under anything other than an abuse of discretion standard?
Well, the defendant could argue, I suppose, that the way the analysis was done was not sufficient under Biggers. Depends on how the court conducts the analysis. And if he didn't properly follow the Biggers analysis, then there would still be a denial of due process argument in that case. Otherwise, it would be abuse of discretion. And the bottom line is cross-examination does not solve the problem here, because as the courts that have adopted Biggers have noted, that the concerns that underlie Biggers, which is the degree of suggestiveness, the chance of misidentification and threat to due process, are still present. It's a systemic problem. The fact that there are people there to be cross-examined does not eliminate the fact that there's a higher degree potential for misidentification. In fact, that's, you know, and this is unusual for the courts to do this type of a gatekeeping function when, in fact, the Getz analysis, for example, a prior bad act, they have to establish, the state or whoever is trying to introduce it, has to establish for the judge that it's plain, clear, and conclusive before it goes to the jury. And that's because due process requires that unreliable evidence not go to the jury. And what's more disconcerting in this case was that it was an unnecessarily suggestive process, because the detective testified that he was afraid that the officer was not going to be able to identify him, so he never did a pretrial procedure. In fact, he didn't do any pretrial identification procedures with anybody, and he testified that was because if they don't know, they might guess. And so this court in Clark versus State indicated that justification, or the government's intent, is very is a factor to consider. And in this case, there was no reason why a trained police officer as the witness would not have been able to been given a proper photo lineup or actual lineup before trial.
So you wanted him to see, under your scenario, 8 faces rather than 20,000 potential faces. So when he gets into the courtroom for the in-court identification, he looks at the defendant and says, that was one of the 8 people I saw. And that makes you feel more comfortable about an in-court identification than if you showed him nothing that would suggest that the person that showed up in the courtroom was indeed someone who had been arrested and was indeed someone who had a record, or was someone that was part of an 8-face photo lineup? That seems bizarre to me.
Well, it's very possible he wouldn't have identified him in that lineup, and that would have obviously helped the defendant at trial, because he wouldn't have been identified previously. The defendant was arrested 17 days after the crime occurred here.
Well, why isn't that the option of the prosecutor, to decide whether or not to take the risk of a pretrial photo lineup or not, or a show-up, or the ever-popular television lineup?
Well, it is. They can do that, but then it's subject to an analysis under whether it's suggestive or unreliable. You know, if that were the only problem here, and it was suggestive, under Biggers, that is not enough to exclude it. And I agree. And that's not why this should have been excluded here, because it was suggestive. It was suggestive, therefore, it had to be reliable, and it was not reliable in this case. That's the problem here.
Do you agree that the conviction and the finding of guilt did not, to use the words of the Ninth Circuit in Domina did not hang entirely on the reliability and accuracy of Blackston's first time in court identification.
I do not agree with that at all. It did hang on that.
I underscore the word entirely.
I believe it did, and here's why. There are two defendants in this case. Both were identified by another witness as being in the neighborhood that day together. That other individual was not identified by Blackston, but was convicted. Mr. Byrd was convicted after being identified. Mr. Pollard, the one that was acquitted, actually had a relationship with the people in the house. He was actually arrested right after the pursuit at the house. Mr. Byrd was not arrested for 17 days and had no relation, or the record didn't reveal any relation with the actual people that owned the home. So it did hang entirely on his particular conviction hung entirely on the officer's description.
Did you want to save the balance of your time?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you.
Good afternoon. Timothy Donovan representing the state. If it please the court.
Before you get started,
yes.
It would help me if you could very quickly summarize what evidence of ID there was other than Officer Blackston's in-court ID.
Certainly, Your Honor. The two next-door neighbors, Mrs. Michelle Butler and her son Denzel, were home that afternoon. Shortly before the burglary occurred, there was a knock on the door, and Calvin Byrd was there. Denzel knew Calvin Byrd from high school, and Mrs. Butler testified that Calvin actually spent the night there once, and that she knew Calvin Byrd. According to both Denzel and Mrs. Butler, Calvin asked to use the bathroom, and Denzel let him do that. Michelle Butler was not pleased at this, but she followed them out, and there were two other young men out there she did not recognize. She asked them what they were doing. They mumbled something in reply. Mrs. Butler did not know, did not remember. And now, according to Denzel, they then went on their way. Again, the Butlers lived directly next door to the house that was burned.
Okay, I think this is getting way more complicated than what I was looking for. What I'm looking for is who, if anyone other than Officer Blackston, was able to identify Byrd as being a participant in this crime?
Yeah, actually, in the house, only Officer Blackston.
Okay.
Only Officer Blackston.
So everybody else was just saying he was nearby or he was in the vicinity,
yes,
or whatever.
Exactly.
Okay.
The two butlers saw him within 10 to 20 minutes of the burglary when the police cars arrived. That's what they were using. So this is, it's the butlers, of course, Officer Blackston didn't know who this person was. And if all we had was Officer Blackston's observations, we could never have found Mr. Byrd. It was only through the next door neighbors that the police were actually able to find out who Calvin, who went to Christiana High School with Denzel Butler, was, and eventually obtain warrants and identify him.
And what was the state's other evidence against Mr. Byrd?
That was it. It was seeing him with three young men within 10 to 20 minutes prior of the police cars arriving in response to the burglary, and Officer Blackston's observations and his in-court identification that this was the gentleman involved. The juvenile was, we were going to use the juvenile as a witness, but he was on the lam at the time and could not be found. So this was the testimony that we were left with. Officer Blackton gave chase to the two people in the house and apprehended the one who turned out to be the juvenile, and the other one escaped completely. Tyrone Pollard was apprehended shortly thereafter in the neighborhood, but Calvin Byrd escaped completely. And again, it was not until the warrants were issued and he was extradited and brought back in.
So as to Byrd, there was no physical evidence that put him at the scene?
No.
He wasn't in possession of any stolen property or anything like that?
No, he was not apprehended there, so whatever he had.
So all you have is Officer Blackston and neighbors who saw him in the vicinity 10 to 20 minutes before,
exactly.
I guess, before the
exactly.
crime.
Exactly. That is the testimony that puts him in the house. And, of course, defense counsel made an objection and mentioned two cases. The first one was Manson versus Brathwaite, and the second one was Neil V. Biggers. And the trial judge said no, because both Manson and Neil V. Biggers deal with an entirely different situation. That's when an unnecessarily suggested pretrial identification procedure taints an in-court identification, and that's simply not the case here. Between the time of the crime, was in, I think, November, and the time of trial in May, roughly 6 months, Officer Blackston testified that he had never seen the defendant personally, had never been shown a photograph of the defendant, and this was coming from his recollection of the incident.
Wait a second. Especially if it's a police officer in a courtroom being asked, look around, officer, do you see the person that you remember you were chasing after this crime?
Yeah.
All he has to do is look to where the defendant is sitting, because that's clearly the person who's on trial here. And assuming that the officer is more interested in getting a conviction than the accuracy of his recall, how much more suggestive could anything be than to have only one person in the entire room who could possibly be the perpetrator?
Granted, and that's a wonderful thing to argue to the jury, and that's what the judge said, basically. This goes to the weight, but it has nothing to do with Manson versus Brathwaite. It has nothing to do with Neil V. Biggers. I'm not going to sustain that kind of objection. This does not go to the admissibility under the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment. This goes to the weight to be accorded to the evidence, and is a matter for jury argument. And defense counsel, Mr. O'Connell, argued at length that this testimony from Officer Blackston was not credible and should be ignored. And I point out also that Ms. Butler, at trial, not only identified Mr. Byrd, whom she knew, she also pointed to Tyrone Pollard and said, yeah, now I remember, he was the other person who was there. And the jury obviously ignored that, said, no, we don't believe that Michelle Butler, who did not know Tyrone Pollard and had told the police originally all she recognized was Calvin Byrd, that Tyrone Pollard was one of these three individuals.
But I take it Officer Blackston was not able to identify Pollard.
No. The only people he saw were the juvenile who he apprehended, obviously, you know, him and Calvin Byrd. Tyrone Pollard had apparently run out before these other two were upstairs, I guess.
It wouldn't be unfair then to say that it was entirely Officer Blackston's testimony that resulted in a conviction for one of them and a not guilty for the other.
No, because the difference, I disagree, Your Honor, and for this reason, that the Butler, first of all, Calvin was identified not only by Mrs. Butler, but also by her son Denzel Butler, and Calvin was known to both of them. Tyrone Pollard was not. Denzel Butler, as a matter of fact, testified and told the police that he couldn't identify, when trial he testified, he couldn't. I never looked at the other two. He couldn't tell whether it was Tyrone Pollard or not. Only Mrs. Butler said, oh, yeah, and that's the other one I saw. And the jury obviously was not impressed with her identification of Mr. Pollard. But she did know Mr. Byrd. As did her son Denzel, so that was really not disputed. They knew each other and had prior dealings with each other. So her identification of Mr. Byrd was much more trustworthy than was her identification of Mr. Pollard. But As far as, I note also, a judge, after ruling that Manson and Neal v. Biggers were simply inapplicable, went on to point out some aspect of reliability here. First of all, this was not simply a momentary glance, but that the officer did chase these two, including Mr. Berg, for some period of time, as he described in his testimony, throughout the neighborhood. So it was more than a one-second glance he had of this fellow. And also, the judge pointed out two things. First of all, the officer is a police officer. And police officers all the time come into court, especially if one goes to traffic court or misdemeanor court, months later, after they had a brief waiting out a ticket or something, are asked by the prosecutor, can you identify the defendant? Oh, yeah, right there. This is what police do for a living, and they get good at it. And this is something that the United States Supreme Court, Manson versus Brathwaite, zeroed in on when they held that showing that police officer a single photograph of the suspect was, yes, not unnecessarily suggestive, but his in-court testimony would be allowed because he was a police officer, and they're just good at this kind of thing. And second, as the judge pointed out, and was also, strangely enough, also in Manson versus Brathwaite, also pointed out by the court, by the United States Supreme Court, Officer Blackston was African American, as was the defendant, and so would be more expected to zero in on more specific areas of physiognomy rather than just say a generic young black man. And Officer Blackston did testify as to certain specific aspects of Mr. Byrd's appearance, his light complexion, and also his cornrow hairstyle, which Mr. Byrd wore both at the time of the crime and at the time of trial. So for these reasons, the judge, I think, correctly ruled that the defendant's objection did not go to the admissibility of the testimony, the identification testimony, but to the weight to be accorded the evidence, and is something that could be pursued on cross-examination as it was and could be pursued in closing summation to the jury, which it also was. If the court has no further questions.
Thank you, Mr. Donovan.
Thank you.
A couple points. First, I cannot find in the court's ruling, I'll allow the court to make that determination, Exhibit A to the opening brief, where the court says it was inapplicable. The court said it was suggestive and then went into a reliability determination. So I think the court did try to make, and his reliability factors simply were not applicable. The fact that the gentleman was wearing cornrows cannot be considered a physically distinctive feature upon which to support reliability, as that's a transient type of a feature. It's not like it was a tattoo or something to that effect. And there are several light-complected black males in the city of Wilmington. Mr. Donovan also talked about the fact that the butlers made a connection for the police. But the Mrs. Butler also saw Mr. Pollard, and I couldn't quite follow Mr. Donovan's argument that hers was more credible with respect to Mr. Byrd. I think that goes to show even more that the jury believed that they relied on the officer's identification, and she also described Pollard in more detail than she did Mr. Byrd. In fact, she gave no description of what he was wearing that day. She couldn't, except to say he had a black backpack, which the officer did not testify as to having seen. She did not testify that he wore cornrows that day, and neither did Denzel Butler. So there was no way to know, to measure the accuracy between those two descriptions that day. And a point of interest is the state, it goes to the unnecessariness, I think, indicates that the juvenile was on the lam. It's interesting to note he actually was in court that day for violation of probation, so he was actually in the same courthouse, and that can be seen in the docket from his case. So the detective was asked at trial, do you know where he is? And he said no, and I believe that, but there, obviously it appears that not much was done to try to get additional corroboration of the officer's identification. And finally, with respect to police officers, and especially in traffic cases doing this all the time, that's true. The significant difference there is police officers writing a ticket for someone is close, they have interactions with them, and it's one-on-one. Arguably, if it's suggestive in the circumstances of the courtroom, oftentimes, this type of analysis could be done, but more times the situations is that it would, in fact, be reliable. And, in fact, it is the custom a lot of times in court of common pleas to ask for defense attorneys to ask the police officer to identify their client in the audience, and they're not able to do that prior to trial, and cases get dismissed for that very reason. Unless the court has any further questions. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and adjourn.